Hello, I'm Bill Fowler, a member of the editorial board of the New England Quarterly. I'm joined today by Professor Richard Brown, the University of Connecticut Board of Trustees, Distinguished Professor Emeritus, and Michael Dukakis, former Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and currently Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Northeastern University. We've gathered to discuss Professor Brown's essay in the June issue of the New England Quarterly, titled Tried, Convicted, and Condemned in Almost Every Barroom and Barbershop, Anti-Irish Prejudice in the Trial of Dominic Daly and James Halligan, Northampton, Massachusetts, 1806. In this essay, Professor Brown investigates how national stereotypes did or did not affect jurors' judgments to convict or acquit. How, he asks, did a vision of America as an asylum of the oppressed and its related ideology of equality before the law comport with the Puritans' notion of the city upon a hill, caught up with, in turn, anti-Catholicism, the doctrine of republican virtue, and insular Yankee xenophobia? Governor Dukakis has kindly joined us, not only as a person thoroughly familiar with the history of the Commonwealth, but also as the chief executive who in 1984 issued a proclamation stating that, quote, the historical record shows that religious prejudice and ethnic intolerance played a significant role in the arrests and trial of Daly and Halligan, which resulted in the denial of their right to due process and a miscarriage of justice. This proclamation came 7 years after Governor Dukakis's perhaps better-known proclamation concerning the infamous Sacco Vanzetti case. Thank you both for being here. Dick, if we could simply begin, I'm curious as to how you came to this topic.
I came to this case as a matter of chance. That is, when I was working on another study of a major capital case, an incest rape trial of Ephraim Wheeler in 1805, in order to set the context for that trial and punishment, I investigated every capital case in Massachusetts between 1780 and 1820, and the Daly and Halligan case of 1806 was one that has a very full trial report and for which there's quite a lot of information, and so I was caught with that, though I left it aside and only took it up later. And the reason I took it up later is that I have been working now for several years on a study of the question of equal rights in the early American Republic. And I have been investigating equal rights with respect to religion, race, class, and ethnicity and national origin. And so the Daly Halligan case was a nice example of question of equal justice or not for two Irish Catholic immigrants.
Governor Dukakis, I'm curious as to how you two came to this, to issue this proclamation, and perhaps some of our listeners might be interested to know. I think many people might assume that as governor you could have issued a pardon, but it was not a pardon, it was a proclamation. So if you help us understand why a proclamation, not a pardon, and how did you happen to come to the Halligan case?
Well, the short answer to the first question, Bill, is that a governor cannot pardon somebody posthumously. I couldn't do that in the Sacco Vanzetti case. I certainly couldn't do it in this case. So when I decided to take some action on the 50th anniversary of the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, the only thing I really could do, other than simply a statement, which might have some semi-official impact, would be to issue a gubernatorial proclamation. But that doesn't have any legal effect in any way. And as in this case, not that I was not thoroughly familiar with Sacco and Vanzetti, because I was, not so in this case. The folks that came to us and said, can the governor do something, needless to say, were people who had been deeply and actively involved in the Sacco Vanzetti case themselves. Oh. Aldino Filicani was the treasurer of the committee. There were others who were still alive. And so, in addition to my own knowledge of the case, in some remote connection, I thought issuing that proclamation, and in effect stating that there had been a serious miscarriage of justice, was probably the most appropriate way to do it and the best way to do it. But a pardon as such simply wasn't something I was authorized to do legally.
Do you remember any public reaction to your proclamations, either Sacco Vanzetti or in the Halligan case?
I certainly remember Sacco Vanzetti. Dave Locke, a Republican senator from Wellesley, suggested that I ought to be impeached. And he was a good friend, but we were about 180 degrees apart philosophically. And I know the Fulop family was not happy because, remember, he had refused to take action, commute the sentence, and so on and so forth. So it was, it's not something that was applauded unanimously by any stretch, but I was familiar with the case as a young intern to a state representative named Alexander Chella. I had worked with him when he tried legislatively to, if not pardon them, issue some kind of official document, bill, resolution, which might in effect do that. And I remember being at the hearings at Gardner Auditorium that were packed at the time. This was back in the 60s when I was, the late 50s when I was a law student, packed over this issue. Michael Mismano, who was one of the defense counsel, came up from Pennsylvania, where he was a member of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania at the time, to testify. And I myself was a young lawyer at Hill and Barlow. And Arthur Hill had been one of the appellate defense counsels in that case. So the firm that I was working in had had a history of this. So I had a lot more background. In this case, I think it must have been, I can't remember, Bill, it must have been people who were familiar with the case and came to me and said, hey, you did this for Sacco and Vanzetti, and this is kind of the Irish Sacco and Vanzetti case. And I took a look at it, we did some research, and said, sounds like the same thing to me, so I did the same thing.
Dick, I think we all appreciate historians are expected to be objective in their inquiries and in their writings. But I'm curious, you mentioned that you've spent a good deal of time looking at the issue of capital punishment in the early days of both the province of Massachusetts Bay and the Commonwealth. Did you have something more in mind when you were investigating the Halligan-Daly case in the greater world and your concern and about capital punishment?
Not really. When I worked with my wife Irene on the Ephraim Wheeler case, we did feel that we should reflect upon the issue of capital punishment, and we did offer a paragraph or two in that work saying that we did not believe that Wheeler needed to have been executed. But we understood the political realities that the governor and the governor's council were facing in 1806 when they determined not to commute the sentence and to deny the petition of over 100 people from Berkshire County. In that case, as in the Halligan and Daly, we were interested in seeing to what degree the Commonwealth lived up to its own standards. And what impressed me a lot about all of the cases, capital cases of this general period, was that the standards that we operate under today were not at all the standards of the early late 18th or early 19th century. Defendants were not permitted to testify because of the concern that they would be tempted to lie under oath, and then the court would be implicated in their eternal damnation. They were expected to lie in their own defense, and therefore they shouldn't be asked to testify. The amount of time spent investigating a case was close to nil and very casual. An attorney had at most 24 hours to prepare the case. And largely, people of the neighborhood provided testimony of what they knew. And there were numbers of cases where people were sent to the gallows on the basis of evidence that would by no means be satisfactory in a 20th or 21st century court. So what I feel in the case of the Halligan and Daly case is that we're in the circumstance of kind of anachronism in the sense of justice. That is, the standards that we would apply in the 20th century of fairness and of evidence were not used at the beginning of the 19th century. And what I found very telling was looking at cases of other foreigners, some Catholic, some not, Italian, as well as Irish, and finding that they seemed to be acquitted or convicted in roughly the same ways that Yankees were acquitted or convicted. And indeed, what was astonishing to me was that the very same court, virtually the same jury that set up the execution of Daly and Halligan, also acquitted an Irishman for the murder of a man in whose house he was staying. So if there is this rampant readiness to convict Irish Catholics of capital crimes, why would it not be in the Busby case, but it would be in the Daly and Halligan case? And there was evidence in the Daly and Halligan case which, while not admissible in court, certainly was circumstantial, and if you wanted to find a conclusion, you were likely to think that Daly and Halligan were in fact guilty. But A third piece of this that I thought was really interesting, is that the attorney general who prosecuted the case was James Sullivan, who was the descendant of an Irish Catholic immigrant. And the person who introduced the issue of Irish Catholicism and prejudice into the courtroom discussion was the defense attorney. And to me, it did seem a bit like the raising of race by Johnny Cochran in the O.J. Simpson trial, that he was using it as a way of creating a kind of reverse psychology so that his jury would bend over backwards not to discriminate against Bailey and Halligan. That's how I read the arguments that the attorney Blake made, but it was a brilliant oration and regarded as a brilliant oration at the time and reproduced.
Governor, I'm curious, as someone who clearly spent so many years in the executive office, and the responsibility, the burden, I would think, to some degree, of pardons, proclamations, setting the record straight, and as someone who knows a good deal about the history of the Commonwealth, to what degree do you think it's important for public figures, particularly political leaders, to be knowledgeable about history in terms of making their decisions? And I would like you to reflect for a moment on Sacco and Vanzetti and on the Halligan case and how it might have helped shape your own views towards capital punishment.
Well, I'm a huge believer in the study of history, Bill. First, because it's just fun. I mean, I don't read fiction because I think it's kind of dull. I mean, the real thing is a hell of a lot more interesting. I'm in the middle of a history of Prohibition, which is one of the most fascinating books I've ever read, and an eye-opener. I mean, you think the Tea Party's a problem. Go back and look at the Dry Movement. I mean, it's incredible and enormously powerful politically, which, by the way, is somewhat reassuring in terms of our ability to pass through these periods to come out on the other side with a reasonable amount of sense. And, you know, the Greeks have an old saying, pathema mathema, which loosely translated means things happen, you're supposed to learn from them. So I'm a huge fan of history just because I think it's fascinating and interesting and because you learn lessons. And I've read Dick's piece and I'm very impressed with it. I certainly didn't have the benefit of his article when I was considering this case. But in the case of Sacco Vanzetti, with which I was quite familiar, you had very much the same kind of situation in those days. This is the Norfolk Superior Court. Defendant sat in a cage, I mean literally, as the jury looked at him. The judge was probably a little crazy. He was subsequently found trying to direct traffic in Harvard Square several years later. He was reported to have said, did you see what I did to those commie bastards? And in point of fact, the bias in that case may have been partly ethnic and partly political, because at the time I was either issuing or had issued the proclamation, my chief counsel, Dan Taylor, who had been deeply involved in putting this together, was asked to be on a panel with, I think, the lone remaining juror, who was then 91 or 92, and quite old. And in the course of that panel discussion, the juror said, but they were communists, which suggested to me that it was less that they were Italians, although there was plenty of anti-Italian prejudice around at the time. And it may have more to do with the fact, of course, they weren't communists, they were anarchists, but this guy thought they were communists. So that was part of it. But there's no question that, as in the case we're talking about, and I think I said that at the time, I'm not sure I said it in the proclamation, Bill, by our standards in 1977, the rules of procedure and our general concept of due process was very different in the 20s. And in point of fact, we all know that it wasn't until the Civil Rights Revolution and all-white juries convicting black folks in the South and so forth that we really started getting serious about extorted confessions and all this kind of stuff, which had been done regularly prior to that time. So there's no question that in doing what I did and in doing what we do, there's a look back, but a look back that applies modern standards. And I don't have any doubt, Dick, that in this particular case, it may very well be that the standards and the procedure at the time in the trial of these guys was what was done generally. But it's a little difficult, and you folks would know better than this. I mean, we all know about anti-Irish prejudice in this state, and it actually got worse as more and more Irish immigrants came here. You know, the know-nothings, the burning of the convent, all that kind of stuff is part of our history. So there was a lot of it around. But, you know, when you say to me, well, what role does history play in what you do as governor? If you're a student of history, one of the things you have to try to do is at least apply the lessons it teaches us. And I found both these cases really interesting because of my own interest in history, and it was fun getting into them. But I certainly didn't have the kind of background in this case that I'd had personally in Sacco Vanzetti. One other quick story, I don't want to go on a great length. My mother came over here when she was 9 from Greece. And thanks to an elementary school principal in Haverhill, she not only stayed in school and finished high school, she was the first Greek-American young woman ever to go away to college in the history of the United States. It was unheard of at the time. This is 1921. And she went to Bates. She was a Phi Beta at Bates. Taught for a couple of years in Ashland, New Hampshire, and then decided she wanted to come back to Boston and teach here, a little closer to home, which was in Haverhill. And she went to, in those days, there were private teachers' agencies, and one of them was run by a woman named Miss Potter. So you went to Miss Potter's agency, and she had listings and stuff. And there was an opening for a junior high school teacher with my mother's qualifications in Walpole, which, as we both know, is in the heart of Norfolk County, where Sacklin Van Zetti was tried. And so she said to Miss Potter, she said, well, this looks interesting. She said, Miss Bukas, I don't think I would apply there. And it was pretty obvious that if your name was Bukas, even if you were a Phi Beta from Bates with 2 years of experience teaching, that was probably a place that you didn't want to apply. So those were the times, in the 20s. And when you add Sacklin Van Zetti's political orientation, you can understand why.
Apropos the Sacklin Van Zetti political orientation, in the same issue of New England Quarterly, there's a review of a book by Moshik Temkin, a Yale University Press book, The Sacco Van Zetti Affair, America on Trial. And I haven't read the book, but the review is by Marianne Trashati, associate professor of rhetoric at Hofstra. And in her review, she notes that the political animus, according to this author, Temkin, was the most powerful part of the movement to destroy Sacco and Vanzetti. And I have to say, having the little reading I've done on it, impressed me with the extent to which the American left and then the international left picked up the Sacco Vanzetti case and made it into a huge public relations affair. So that in the end, it seems to me that in many respects, it was a public relations war between the left and the right in which Sacco and Vanzetti were fundamentally pawns.
You know, it is interesting, Dick, in your essay, and you mentioned now Sacco Vanzetti, and you as well, Governor, that in the case of Halligan and Daley, you seem to suggest that ethnic bias or anti-Catholicism was not necessarily a driving element. Are we suggesting that there was far more prejudice in the case of Sacco Vanzetti than in Halligan and Daley? And I guess my question there would be, how does an historian deal with the issue of motivation? In Sacco Vanzetti, because of the publicity, the newspapers, et cetera, we have fair evidence of the bias involved there. And with Daley and Halligan, it seems less evident in the printed material, and you seem to suggest, Dick, that it wasn't a driving force. But I think in our own time with the issue of racism, where no one, or very few people certainly, would admit to being racist, and yet it is an undercurrent in our society. And how does an historian get at that sub-level of motivation?
Prayer. This is really very tricky. That's a very sophisticated question to address. What I'd say is that you use the printed record and manuscript record, behavioral evidence, and then you wonder whether you have found leading or lagging indicators. So, for example, I've done now a significant amount of work on the emergence of what I would call anti-Irish prejudice, and particularly the association of the Irish with Catholicism. And what I've found is that in the 18th century, broadly speaking, and it isn't only, I mean, I'm relying to a significant extent on other scholars, the Irish were kind of lumped together, Northern Irish, Southern Irish, Protestant Irish, Catholic Irish. In America, they didn't really pay much attention. They were just Irish, and they were stereotyped to some degree as hard-drunking, two-fisted, rough-and-tough frontiersmen. And to some degree, they were recruited as frontiersmen because they'd stand up to the Indians and were willing to tolerate rough living conditions. And there was a masculine culture, which they, as male immigrants, brought with them, which was suited to or thought to be suited to the frontier environment. And I found in Massachusetts, for example, you don't start to see a real distinction between the two kinds of Irish until really after 1810 and much more after 1820. And I just saw, and this is a piece of evidence, you can see how you would interpret it, an advertisement in a Boston newspaper, a young man advertising that he was available to run a tan works. And he mentions that he is just over from Ireland in his advertisement. So I would assume that if you thought it was a negative to mention that you were just over from Ireland, you wouldn't mention it. But he mentioned it. I note that the name Sullivan did not prove to be a significant handicap to James Sullivan in his political career and when he was elected governor in 1807-8. And in fact, you do see the issue. I mean, Harrison Gray Otis, arch Federalist leader, got into a conflict, a newspaper conflict, and some oral with James Sullivan and made nasty cracks about the Wild Irish. And Sullivan took him up and answered him point by point by point. So I do believe that there's anti-Irish sentiment in New England broadly and perhaps throughout North America. And some of it is brought over from Britain. There is certainly anti-Irish and anti-Catholic sentiment in England. And Guy Fawkes Day is, celebration of the frustration of the Popish plot. And there's the celebration of Pope's Day in Boston. There is this long anti-Catholic, and there's the Dudleyan Lectures that are an annual lecture against popery. So there's no denying that there's a kind of structural anti-Catholicism in New England and in Massachusetts. But in ordinary conduct of people and behavior, there are a lot of other intervening factors. And I don't think that, as Governor Dukakis mentions, the burning of the Ursuline Convent in 1834. I mean, that's a real striking, dramatic example of anti-Catholicism, but it's not anti-Irish. The really nasty expressions of anti-Irish sentiment, I think, tend to be with the famine migration and following.
Governor, to what degree, you as a political leader, and certainly current political leaders, what degree do you think political leaders have a responsibility to recognize miscarriages of justice, bad things that have happened in the past, and while we can't fix them, to recognize them? And I think of the current situation in America, of the number of things we reflect on in our own history, and there seems to be too often a tendency to want to ignore them and move ahead. Do political leaders have a responsibility to say and to bring to the public our past?
I think so. But it obviously depends on the political leader. Bill Clinton went to Greece and apologized for our support of the military junta.
You don't see that as a weakness?
No. And he did the same thing in Guatemala many years after we overthrew the democratic government of Guatemala. And I admired him for it. I respected him for it. Thought it was a good thing to do. But there aren't too many American presidents.
I'm sort of wondering about the Japanese Americans who had to go through the court system and finally to Congress and won some reparations for the trampling of their constitutional rights in the Second World War. And I don't know what the record of American presidents after Franklin Roosevelt with respect to the Japanese Americans and whether any American president ever apologized.
It's a good question.
For that. I mean, to me, there are certain kinds of historic wrongs that are, I think, very complicated. For example, Native Americans in warfare. Native Americans killed a lot of settlers. Settlers killed a lot of Native Americans. Various American jurisdictions broke treaties that were made. And the issue of culpability is, I think, quite complicated with respect to Native Americans and often rather particular. But where you have a case like the Japanese Americans, where what the Constitution is supposed to protect is pretty clear, and where in wartime a certain class of people are singled out and put in internment or concentration camps, depending on your political orientation, you know, that seems so clear, a travesty, that there should be a responsibility to respond.
Does that responsibility extend to historians?
I think so. I mean, historians' first task is not to sit as judges. They're no better qualified than anybody else to sit as judge. The historian's task is to try to figure out as near as they can what the accurate representation of events ought to be. But having then engaged in that study and informed themselves, I think they ought not to stop at the edge and say, well, here's my report, make of it what you will. I think they certainly have a responsibility to say, and this is what I make of it. You may not accept that part of it. I also would reject wholeheartedly historians who act the role of lawyers and build up a one-sided case for a particular argument. We've seen people on several sides do this with respect to the right to bear arms in the early republic. And the historical record in the state legislatures seems to me to be quite mixed, though I think the Second Amendment is pretty clear in tying the right to bear arms to the maintenance of a militia. In some of the state constitutions, that collective defense aspect is not clearly spelled out. It's different. So I think of a work, Michael Belisle's Arming America, which I believe used historical evidence and in some cases perhaps fabricated evidence to build a case against Second Amendment rights and arms. And that I don't think a historian ought to do. I think our task is to inform others, and we certainly can enter the discussion and debate, but people like Governor Dukakis are elected in order to make determinations.
Well, I do think that you talked very eloquently in your essay about the standards of justice in the early 19th century here in Massachusetts, and I think about recognizing perhaps a miscarriage of justice, but it does seem to me, and I'd ask you, Governor, it seems to me there's a little sense of optimism here, some tiny sense perhaps, that our standards of justice have improved, and that perhaps we can say that your proclamations and forcing us as citizens of the Commonwealth to reflect upon these two events make us ever more conscious of what has happened in the past, trying to avoid it in the future. Do you think that your proclamations have helped? Was that something in your mind?
No question about that. Yeah. And we have come, it's not tiny, Bill. I mean, light years. Yeah. In terms of our conception of due process and fair treatment and this kind of stuff, issues of ethnicity and race today. This city was practically torn apart over the issue of race, and that wasn't that long ago. So, I think these are things that we've got to be thinking about and reviewing all the time. But, I mean, it's just no question when it comes to procedural due process and what we mean by that, that today's standards are just dramatically different from what they were in the 1920s, let alone the 1820s. And I think that's a good thing, and we ought to, at least to some extent, take a certain amount of pride in the fact that while it's a work in progress always, that that's happened. And I think examining history is important. When 9/11 took place, my memory may be entirely clear, but I believe, Dick, that the Japanese internment and what happened to the Japanese was raised maybe by George Bush himself.
It was.
And he said, we're not doing that to the Arab community in this country. And I thought that was a very impressive thing for him to do, citing the Japanese situation in World War II, where a liberal president did something which today, I think all of us agree, was appalling. It was unconstitutional, and it was confirmed by the Supreme Court of the United States at the time, with some people on it who we all kind of considered to be rootin' tootin' liberals and so on. So I was impressed with the fact that President Bush used that as an example in urging people not to direct their anger at Arab Americans in this country. And I think that's a very appropriate and an effective use of history, and I commend him for it.
Well, gentlemen, I think this has been wonderful. Dick, I want to thank you for your fine scholarship and explicating the past for us. And I think, Governor Dukakis, you represent the very best in political leadership that recognizes the uses of the past. And between us all, there's hope for progress. And I think that's what we see here today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill.
This has been an MIT Press Journals podcast. For more information on the New England Quarterly or any of our publications, please visit our website at www.mitpressjournals.org.